This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and let's shake things up with a warning. They are coming. Maybe they're already here. The neo-experts, brainiacs from the worlds of sociology, neuroscience, design, and many other fields. Here's neuroscientist Samuel Wong from Princeton.
What is going to be happening in the next few years is that neuroscientists are going to start addressing more and more complex phenomena and dealing with phenomena at different levels and starting to understand phenomena at one level in terms of the levels, say, immediately below it or immediately above it. And I think that connecting of different levels is something that's going to eventually encompass many kinds of human behavior, including, for instance, disciplines such as psychology.
And psychology means neuroscientists want to crack at politics. Coming up, Sam Wong will take a shot at the 2016 election. Designers are also pushing out of their narrow fields and coming to our world, the real world.
What we're seeing now is this proliferation of different devices that are, you know, moving out from the cell phone and onto our bodies and into the world.
Here are neo experts Sean Fulmer and David Rose from MIT. They want to crack at designing your home. Be afraid. Be very afraid.
Designers, as well as computer scientists, are going to really make a really big impact in the type of technology that we see in the home.
The history of computers has mostly been about efficiency. I think one of the things that's changing is that enchanted objects can be about adding motion and add magic to the fabric of our everyday lives and experiences.
Later this hour, a veteran designer will caution us to look closely at the fashionable promises of visionaries who see only more gadgets in your future. We will also hear from a sociologist whose view of the U.S. criminal justice system is less Law and Order and more Charles Dickens. But first, can that neuroscientist be a neo-expert in 2016 politics? Why not? We have a neo-candidate, right, in the form of Donald J. Trump.
We're led by a man that either is not tough, not smart, or he's got something else in mind. And the something else in mind, you know, people can't believe it. People cannot they cannot believe that President Obama is acting the way he acts and can't even mention the words radical Islamic terrorism. There's something going on. It's inconceivable.
Princeton neuroscientist Sam Wong, now founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. Welcome, Sam. And what are the signs that Trump's candidacy has shaken up that electoral map?
Well, surprisingly, despite all the disruption of the primaries, especially on the Republican side, things are lining up according to familiar divides. Voting patterns across America for the last four presidential elections have been pretty similar, which is why we get to call states red and blue. And things are mostly the same with a few exceptions. So I would say that where Romney was strong, Trump is strong. Where Obama was strong, Hillary Clinton is strong.
And why would that be? The parties have a stronger identity than the candidates?
Well, let's see. So that is approximately the case. So if you look at American voting patterns, looking at the data, the biggest realignment in the last 50 years was going from 1960 to 1964 after Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. And at that time, there was a bigger realignment where the South was lost to the Democrats. But pretty much people seem to be dividing along partisan lines. The only exceptions to this pattern this year are places where Ted Cruz was strong in the primaries. If you look in a few data points that are a little scanty but are starting to show some hints, it looks like Donald Trump might be actually pretty weak in heartland states like Utah and Kansas, where he lost pretty resoundingly to Ted Cruz.
And in those data points that are kind of tantalizing and surprising in some ways, it's because Donald Trump doesn't have a coherent ideology, which is what the folks in Utah and Kansas expect?
It's hard to know what the reason is. He's really not a standard candidate. And so, for instance, just to pick an example, in Kansas, Mitt Romney won Kansas by, I believe, 18 percentage points 4 years ago. And right now, he, Trump and Clinton are tied with about 20% undecided. So if you look at those numbers, it looks like a possibility is that there are Republicans who are sitting on the fence who would normally always vote Republican, but they just cannot quite bring themselves to vote for someone like Trump and all the baggage he comes with.
You know, what is the possibility that there might be a realignment along the cleavage of jobs and the need for jobs? Certainly in the South, the unemployment rates tend to be higher than in the North and in the West. And it's conceivable that people who are turned off by Donald Trump or who view over the last couple of weeks statements that he's made as just too reckless, you know, to be taken seriously, would vote unwillingly, reluctantly, but nevertheless for a kind of economic pragmatism and go with Hillary Clinton, thinking that at least there would be some sort of economic continuity here?
I certainly think it's possible that some of these southern states could go in a way that we haven't come to expect in the last four elections. And so, for instance, just to pick an example, there has been some polling showing Trump relatively weak in Mississippi. I don't necessarily expect Trump to lose Mississippi, but I think that just the fact that there's weakness there is interesting. Generally, when it comes to realignments, there could be a realignment, I would say, but I think it might be better to think about Trump as being the consequence of a long realignment in which those voters you're talking about with their anxieties have finally found someone to coalesce around. And so, for example, 1960 to 1964 was a big realignment. The South went away from the Democrats. But recall that that year, Barry Goldwater lost quite badly. And so a realignment doesn't mean a win for the other party. It just means that things are shifting around.
So then if we're going to take Donald Trump as Barry Goldwater, a hitting of bottom, which this election could be for the GOP, might mean that there will be some fundamental realignment of voters under the umbrella of, say, even a third party or a replacement party for the GOP as early as, you know, 2024 or 2028, which would time it about the time that 1980 Ronald Reagan ushered in the realignment with the Reagan Revolution.
That's an interesting thought to project that far ahead. I think that
you're a neuroscientist. You can do that.
So I can look ahead. Okay, if I get to project that far ahead, it's quite science fictional. If I get to project that far ahead, then I think that what we saw this year, I think if we just stop and think about it, we really saw the failure of the nominating mechanism of one major political party where two outsiders, Trump and Cruz, ended up as the final two contenders. And either because of their rules, which allow somebody with less than 50% to get the nomination, 50% of the vote, that is, or because of a disconnect between voters in the Republican Party and elites, something big happened there. And it is an interesting question whether that's going to carry on beyond this year, because one could imagine that I'm not sure about a third party, but, you know, one could imagine maybe some fundamental change in what the Republican Party is. That is something that we could not rule out at this point.
Between now and November, though, can Trump soften up Pennsylvania, or could Hillary soften up Texas?
I would say that, roughly speaking, things are in some key states that we've started to watch over the last few elections are surprisingly close. Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania, in April and May polls, were all within 3%. Now, that's data taken before the Democratic nomination started to consolidate and before Bernie Sanders has started to make noises about reconciling. It's before the latest wave of racist and incendiary statements from Donald Trump. So, you know, what will happen? We should watch the June data. If Trump holds up in those states, then probably those are states to watch. If he does not hold up in those states, then we could be in for a not very close election.
Sam Wong is a neuroscientist at Princeton University and a data analyst and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium. Sam, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And now a traditional expert on politics to give evidence if Donald Trump's statements over the last few days have caused any GOP voter regrets.
One of the folks on television said, boy, has Trump gotten under his skin. But he was more angry, and a lot of people have said this, the level of anger, that's the kind of anger he should have for the shooter and these killers that shouldn't be here.
It's the presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump speaking about President Obama, speaking about the Orlando shooting to a sea of supporters in Greensboro, North Carolina this week. Here's Pennsylvania-based Republican strategist Kim Alfano from about a month ago.
Listen, he's a misogynistic jerk. Nobody doubts that. I'd be the first person on a playground to probably walk over and slap that kid if I met him. But at this moment in our history, we really do dramatically need some very disruptive and different ways of approaching things. And if that's Donald Trump, you know, like I said, I won't like him, but I'll probably vote for him.
Kim Alfano joins us now, Pennsylvania-based Republican strategist, CEO of the Alfano Communications Group. Kim, how are you feeling now? We certainly have disruptive.
I kind of liken Donald Trump to a race car driver who's hitting that point in the race where the car starts shaking. And there's two ways he can go. He's either going to crack up or he's going to power through. And this week gives me evidence that he's going to crack up.
Now, crack up in the sense that he's just going to become so ridiculous that there's no possible way for him to proceed.
I don't doubt that Donald Trump is going to throw a convention that's insane. I don't doubt that he'll proceed. I just think that he is now slicing off the people that were holding their nose and trying to deal with this. I think he's starting to slice them off because he's gone from jerky and arrogant to sort of messianic and crazy.
Now, maybe he doesn't want the hold your nose crowd like you and your pals. And messianic and crazy has been a formula that's worked in the past in, you know, modern history.
Again, I think there's a deep desire for, like I said, a disruptive quality. There's a deep desire for someone to do things differently because clearly for the last 10 or so years, things aren't working. And I think we want to see our border secured and get some reform in immigration. We want to see jobs come back to this country. But there's a fear of a reckless leader. There's a fear of someone who is demonstrating recently that this is not really about the country. It's about Donald Trump.
Let's talk scenarios before we go. I mean, could Trump organize some sort of passing of the torch in a way at the convention if he decides that he just doesn't see any sort of pleasant future here?
You know, predicting in this race is a fool's job. I think there's a few things that can happen. He may be able to rein it in. I think he hasn't faced a month like the month that he just had. And as a businessman, I'm praying and hoping that he realizes that he needs to start taking advice and that he needs to come back 10 degrees from the edge of crazy. It would be catastrophically unheard of to have something happen at our convention or to have another Republican nominee somehow become a Republican nominee. So I think he goes to November. And frankly, he may be able to, with the anger that's running through the country, he may be able to win.
Kim Alfano is a Republican strategist based in Pennsylvania and a CEO of Alfano Communications. Thanks so much.
Hey, anytime. Thanks.
If someone had actually designed this feature of the criminal justice system to entrap the poor, you couldn't do better than what happened to Haley Wood from Alabama. Here in the documentary To Prison for Poverty, she tells the story of how a $41 traffic ticket became a more than $300 debt and possible prison term.
Here is the actual ticket I got. I paid $10, fees $35, and then fine balance $41. The fine has not been touched, not one time, all the money I've paid. And see this paper right here? It says if you fail to appear, a warrant will be issued for your arrest.
It costs money to get justice, and courts and collection companies charge fees and collect fines from rich and poor alike. But for the poor, pay-for-use fees can be so onerous that going to jail may be the only way to get out from under a debt. Jail time, even though there has been no criminal conviction. It took a sociologist to show the national scale of this problem. In her book, A Pound of Flesh, Monetary Sanctions as Punishment for the Poor, Alexis Harris says, in this system, there are no appeals and no recourse for defendants. The whole system, she says, is like a Charles Dickens debtor's prison nightmare.
Since the inception of the criminal justice system in the United States, we've always used fines to punish people. But increasingly, since the 90s and 2000s, state legislators have added additional fees. And the fees are solely meant to recoup costs associated with processing defendants through the court system, for the cost of their public defense, for the cost of their prosecution, for the cost of court paperwork, even for the cost to house them a daily rate in jail or in prison.
Have courts ruled that these fees are valid, that they don't constitute a penalty without due process?
Well, so there have been different case law at the state level and at the United States Supreme Court that have established that this is allowable, that you can impose costs, particularly the cost of the public defender has been challenged. But the courts have found that as long as the cost is imposed after conviction, then the debt to the defendant for the cost of the public defense does not interfere with the quality of defense. There's been cases, Bearden v. Georgia, that established this concept of willful nonpayment. However, there were no clear criteria provided to judges that mandated how judges would establish this. So what has happened is some judges that I've observed in Washington State look at the women's manicures and ask them how much they spend on their manicures, ask people how much they spent on cigarettes, how much they spent on their tattoos, and say, you know, you spent this money on sort of your body, and you could have spent it on your legal financial obligations. So the problem is that the protections aren't clear enough. They're too ambiguous for judges to loosely interpret them and lead to the incarceration of poor people.
And we should note that these kinds of questions about, well, what did you spend on cable TV or what did you spend on recreation, are deliberately not asked in the welfare office, that basically there's an understanding that people have their own lives and can make their own decisions. How come that can be asked openly in the courts?
It's because these state statutes are so loosely determined. I think regular people who have no contact with the criminal justice system would be shocked to see how much discretion on the ground level courts have, judges have, to manage the lives, particularly the lives of poor people who come before them.
Can you describe how I might find myself caught in a net that results in increasing debt and increasing restriction of freedom all the way to the point where I might actually get incarcerated?
Right. Common example of myself. Several years ago, I was pulled over by a very nice police officer for speeding. I hadn't had a ticket in the prior 7 years. And so he said, you can apply online for this deferred finding. You have to pay for it in addition to the fine of the ticket. But if you don't get a ticket for another year, then it won't affect your insurance rates. So, you know, I'm a professor. I had the money. I went to pay for both the ticket and to enter into this deferred process. Had I not had that money, I might have not paid my ticket, and then I would have lost my driver's license. The next time I was pulled over, I would be arrested for driving with a suspended license. And this is a common practice in Washington that many, many people, particularly people who are poor, that don't have the ability to pay traffic tickets, will result in incarceration in jail.
Is it the case that people are incarcerated because they can't pay a $35 a month fee or a payment towards a fee?
Oh, definitely. That people have set a $20, $30, $50 minimum monthly payment, but they can't pay it. And even people who are unemployed or who receive disability insurance, they're told that they have to pay something. Can you ask your mom for the money? Can you, you know, ask your employer for money? You know, I sat in this one public collections unit, and this one young man came and said he didn't have money for his payment, but he was getting his educational loan in the next couple of weeks. And they said, make sure you come and make your payment when you get that check.
So the court took the educational loan?
Yes, yes. They take money out of disability payments. I saw a man come to that window saying there was a problem, and I guess he was $100 short for making the payment for his wife. He said his wife was disabled, and it was around Christmas, and they said, well, when can you anticipate paying this $100? He said, I'll get my bonus on the 26th. And they said, well, make sure you come and pay that. And he said, they won't come knocking, meaning they won't come knocking on my door to take her to jail. And the clerk said, no, they shouldn't, but make sure you keep that receipt and show you made a payment. So we literally have people walking around on the street carrying their receipts, hoping that they will not be picked up by the police if stopped and taken to jail.
Now, you might think in this situation that, you know, somebody's making money hands over fist here, that this is keeping the taxes down in the state of Washington, that it's paying for salaries of public workers or something. Is this a valid revenue source, even though it looks good to legislators who vote these fees in?
So this is the rhetoric. This is what clerks' offices will say in any state that you go to. But I bet that you cannot find one clerk in the United States that can show you that this is cost effective, that they cannot look at all of the amount of money that they spend for their public collection units, for the arresting of non-payment, for the incarceration of non-payers, and contrast that with the amount of money they recoup. They cannot account for this practice financially. So I really argue that this is an inefficient process in terms of raising money for the criminal justice system. It's ineffective, and it's real unethical treatment of poor people in our society. I'd like to say the vast majority of us have received speeding tickets. So I'd like to think that I'm not that different. So only wealthy people can speed, or only wealthy people can make mistakes in society. Is that the type of America we have? But the bottom line is that it's unethical treatment of poor people to saddle them with this debt, to create a very different experience of punishment for poor people versus wealthy people in society, and not allow them to ever atone or redeem themselves in society.
Alexis Harris, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Alexis Harris is a sociologist at the University of Washington and author of A Pound of Flesh, Monetary Sanctions as Punishment for the Poor. Summer relief arrives officially in the next few days, and while the weather is a blessing, designing a summer that is both fun and functional is just a dream for families in the working class. While platinum-carded subscribers to glossy travel magazines can book themselves into one of the top 10 island getaways or jungle canopy spas or hotels carved into glaciers, for most families, when school is out, there is the terror of summer logistics. In 2014, families across the U.S. planned to spend an average of $958 per child on summer camps and lessons, according to the New York Times. In Dallas, Texas, a local nonprofit estimated that there are about 140,000 children who will spend the summer unsupervised. Even if those families wanted to send their children to camp, there's only 11,000 affordable camp spaces available in the area. Jessica Suarez, a working mom, was not optimistic about the summer of 16.
We are considered low-income families, and it's very, very difficult to be able to find a program that's cost-effective in this community.
But Jessica was thrilled when her 7-year-old got a scholarship to a reading summer program. She shared her joy with Dallas KERA reporter Courtney Collins.
Having a program like Readers to Leaders to come to that's going to make him think outside of his box, help him develop and become more creative and give him a better quality of life is very, very important.
Here in New York City, Dreema Brown is the vice president of school-age programs for the Children's Aid Society, and she says her programs fill up fast each spring.
Every summer, all of our programs have waiting lists, and we serve about 2,500 children across more than a dozen programs, and all of those programs have waiting lists. And what we find in our parent orientations is parents get really excited about the kinds of things that we do during the summer that give their children a chance to engage with their peers through exploring the, you know, wonderful resources of their local communities, as well as engaging in service projects, fun trips. We do things during the summer like robotics. We try to give children an opportunity to pick books that they really love to read and to talk about them with each other and caring adults in a really relaxed setting. You know, you'll see when you come to our camps, children sitting under trees reading in the park during the summer.
And your programs are free?
Our programs are free to low cost. So the vast majority of our programs are free because, you know, we work in lower-income communities.
Are they means-tested? In other words, you have to fill out a lot of paperwork to be eligible for your programs?
No. You just have to make sure we have everything we need to take good care of your child during the summer, make sure we know if they have any allergies or other things we should know. And, you know, for us, that's a really important piece because we want to make sure that these programs are accessible and we remove any barriers that families may have for them. And we want to make sure that every child we can possibly serve has access.
In the city, the potential for adventures is great. You've got museums, you've got the parks, you've got athletic fields and various kinds of unorganized sports activities that are fun to do. Why have we evolved away in the last generation from just kids having fun on their own? I mean, I remember when, mom would say, get out of the house, turn it off the TV, go find something to do. That's not necessarily a comfortable option these days.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think especially in education, and I was a former teacher and a principal, I think we have focused a lot on preparing children for college and career, which is important. So the summer is a really exciting time for us because we get to work with teachers and principals, and we get to say, you know, if you could have your kids do anything in the world during the summers, what would you have them do? And they give us lots of great ideas, and some of them work with us during the summers to make sure our programs are enriching. But, you know, we really do see the summer as an opportunity to really connect children to each other and to do that through our group leaders who are usually college and high school students from their own community who serve as powerful mentors.
Is there advice that you would have, say, a family can only afford 1 or 2 weeks, but the summer is much longer than that, ways of taking advantage of peers or maybe siblings or extended family, friends, uncles who live, you know, down the street? It often seemed as though the stoop culture in the summer city was a way of learning things from, you know, Uncle Joe, and that those kinds of things, if kids are directed enough, can pick up where a camp left off maybe a week before.
Websites like the National Summer Learning Association has great resources and other links to other resources. The key is to make sure that children are actually reading books they want to read during the summer, that they've chosen, and that they can read without help and support from anyone else. That we then talk to them about those books. We ask them questions, find out, you know, what it reminds them of in their own lives, and that we make sure they have an opportunity to see or do something new, even if it's on the weekends when we're not working, or we have a trusted and caring adult do something like that with them during the day, taking advantage of, you know, all the free parks and museums in the cities.
In New York City, Dreema Brown is the vice president of school-age programs for the Children AIDS Society, which offers free summer camps at about a dozen locations across the city. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Brandon from Dallas. I actually have two children, 7 and 14. My 7-year-old goes to daycare, which is the same price year-round. My daughter goes actually nowhere. She stays home and just sits on the couch. The camps that we looked at were about $300 a week, which is a little bit pricey for us. So that's how we do summer.
How do you do summer? From Brunswick, Georgia, don't get me started. This is a major hurdle, not just in the summer, but all on holidays as well. The answer is a combo of family, camps, daycare, and time off.
This is Robert in Oklahoma City. We're very lucky. My wife is a teacher, and we have lots of family. But I know that these so-called day camps for these kids cost upward to $300 a week. Easy.
Austin, Texas. I save all year to afford enough camps, family visits, and other piece-together activities to keep my son busy so I can work full-time as a single mom. It costs no less than $165 a week for some camps, and that's very limited availability. And he can only go for 2 weeks. Then it's more expensive. Camps for $250 to $400 a week, it costs me about $1,800 to $2,400 per summer. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. Comment at thetakeaway.org. Ordinary stuff gets made, but the coolest stuff we wear and use and covet, that all gets designed. We have an understanding of how the iPhone's design represents features we didn't realize we wanted and now can't do without. But very few things meet that test of design. And as the value of design becomes more evident, the temptation to turn design into some magic vitamin D ingredient is irresistible, sold to consumers without really being relevant to the product. Artisanal ice cubes, right? Designer shoelaces. It can get and is quite absurd. Over the past few decades, the notion that design is intrinsically connected to what it means to be human has been blurred with the ever-present priority to make things cool. Jessica Helfand is a designer, a theorist, and author of a series of essays in her latest book, Design, The Invention of Desire. Design, she says, should be intentional, not stylish. It should be about doing the right thing in a human-centered way, heartfelt and free of what is morally corrupt.
A lot of the incentive for writing these essays was to try to look at how easy it is to have design become this kind of panacea, this kind of, if something looks good, you believe in it more. And that's, in a sense, not really a legitimate reason for design to exist. It's not honest.
Would you say that the green movement has attempted to marshal the forces of design to make a lot of things that may or may not be green look good?
Yes, yeah, same with organic food, right? Mm-hmm. It's very easy to call yourself a designer for good. It's very easy to say, you know, I recycle my plastic and compost my garden, therefore I am an honorable person. A lot of those people are still torrenting music. A lot of those people are still, you know, maybe not doing the right thing.
As you say, design makes things look good and we don't think about what's underneath. How can the ethos of design become more transparent, more visible in a world where appearance is so, you know, paramount?
I give examples in the book of, you know, the notion that viral is thought of as a good thing. It comes from the word virus, not such a good thing. Hacking, a vituperative word. It's a laceration to the senses. And so we tend to applaud disruption. words that really are unkind. You can't call yourself a designer for good and do things and participate in a culture that privileges behaviors that are, in a sense, so unkind. And so part of the reason a book to me made sense was to start to look at language that could penetrate a culture of accepting biases that might not, in fact, be good.
So to deconstruct what you were saying just there, we should not be satisfied with the idea, well, it went viral, so therefore it's good.
Right.
We'll worry about all the details later. It went viral. That's all we need.
It's a kind of tautological loop. I mean, I think social media becomes a kind of ecosystem that can amplify and overly distribute these things. And we don't spend the time. We're not rewarded for spending any amount of time to penetrate an idea that's not trending.
The tools that are available online in YouTube and in editing and in Photoshop and all those kinds of visual tools that allow you to play around with stuff that's in the public domain has been an opportunity for people looking at this presidential campaign to create all sorts of satirical instant reaction videos and memes that poke fun at some of the outrages of this campaign, as though that is a political statement. When I sometimes feel as though, you know, I'm tired of laughing, and it just feels like there's so much of this digital, designy noise coming at me.
We live at a moment, I think, in which anybody with a smartphone is expected to have a kind of a visual literacy. That visual literacy is not hard won. It's easily adapted by downloading, uploading, participating in any of the channels that make us all essentially look the same. Right, so our email looks the same, our Facebook looks the same, our Twitter, our Vine videos, everything looks the same. We're part of this templated world, and yet at the same time, we have brands that then become our own way of bringing the traffic back to us. But you're right. I mean, there's a great history of propaganda and of designers and posters and political caricature and people who are visual using their capacity to express an opinion about a political moment that might have impact. But I think this is a moment where it's a scary time to be doing that, because the stuff actually gets out of our hands so quickly. And the things that actually go viral aren't necessarily the things that advance any of us. And I think rarely do we stop and think, before I post that, what am I really doing, except waiting for people to give me a thumbs up.
Let's talk about the pure impulse of design. When you're making something and you've had a couple of iterations, there have been some failures, and they're sitting there on your desk, and you're working on number five, and you start to see where your impulse to actually see it through to the end is going to make a change that someone will probably love, but that's still a bet because you haven't tried it out yet.
Right.
Where do you find that today? That's sort of my dad's generation, industrial designer generation. Where is that going on?
That generation of people, Paul Rand, who was my advisor in graduate school, you know, worked alone, famously, in a house, in a studio, was very averse to market research, to what today we would call beta testing. There is a kind of a, you know, design by committee thing. This idea that there's a word that I'm quite concerned about, a term which is co-creating. What is co-creating? Somebody has to have had the idea. But I think what's at risk is that vision and that moment and that belief that maybe the thing that you want to say is valuable and doesn't have to be watered down or shouldn't be watered down by endless participation and checking that everybody likes it and has given it the thumbs up. That assumes that everybody's opinion is valuable, which it is in a democracy. We live in an incredibly democratic moment of transparency. But there are losses in that.
The design by committee whiteboard image of design suggests we can go in all directions at once, when if we really want to know what's going on in the world, we can't. We have to choose some and reject others.
Correct.
But the future is the whiteboards and the brainstormers.
Do you think so? I'd like to think the future is not the whiteboards. Michael Bayrud and I are starting a new program at Yale in the School of Management. We're banning Post-it notes from our classes.
Oh, my God.
We're introducing tracing paper. Why tracing paper? Tracing paper is forgiving. And it allows you to see what came before. It's like a membrane. You can actually understand that a process of evolution of an idea can be lateral. It can be layered. It's like a palimpsest of an idea, as opposed to this notion that everything we think and produce and make is a composite of squares. That idea that geometry is the container through which all of our ideas must work and become modular. I mean, one could argue it comes out of the Industrial Revolution. It comes out of the international style. But it's not forgiving. It's not porous. And it's not, I think, organic in terms of a process that design can bring to bear on a number of questions and ideas and problems. And so part of what we're trying to do is not to turn business students into designers, but to almost start to teach design as a second language.
Jessica Helfand is co-founder of Design Observer and author of Design, the Invention of Desire. She's on the faculty of the Yale School of Art and the Yale School of Management. And good friend. Thanks so much.
I'm delighted to talk to you. Thanks, John.
And here's something to take with you today. Designers have stepped up from around the world to come up with solutions to address the quality of life for refugees around the world. More than 600 entries from designers and architects from 69 countries. They include a refugee-ready backpack to carry kids and belongings, a communications app to alert refugees to the rights in different countries they might be passing through or applying for residency in, an app for quick regime change, a spray that neutralizes guns, and something to convert refugee camp dust into food and medicine. We're not among the entries. There is still time. Five winners will be named at the What Designers Can Do conference in 2 weeks in Amsterdam. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.